Welcome to the Philosophy as a Way of Life podcast. I am Massimo Piliucci from the City College of New York, and with me is my co-host Rob Coulter from the University of Wyoming. Before we get started, I'd like to announce the next episode of the podcast, which will feature author John Sellers on Epicureanism as a Philosophy of Life. Join us on Thursday, April 21st at 2 p.m. Eastern Time for that one. Notice it's 2 p.m., not our regular 4 p.m. time. To register for that event, go to meetup.com and look for New York Agora. If you wish to hear past episodes of Philosophy as a Way of Life, go to anchor.fm/Philosophy as a Way of Life or check us out on Spotify. Let me introduce today's topic. We're going to talk about the Good Life Method, reasoning through the big questions of happiness, faith, and meaning with Megan Sullivan and Paul Blanchcombe, who are here with us today. Megan is the Wesley Family College Professor in Philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. Her first book, Time Biases, was published by Oxford University Press. Her work has been supported by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Andrew Mellon Foundation, and the John Templeton Foundation. She has degrees from the University of Virginia, Oxford University, and Rutgers, where she earned a PhD in philosophy. Paul Blanchcombe is an assistant teaching professor in philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. He has completed an MA in philosophy at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and a PhD at the University of Notre Dame, and he has held the Andrew Mellon Postdoctoral Fellowship prior to being appointed to his current position. Okay, welcome to our guests, and Rob and I have agreed that the first question is somewhat natural. We are curious about how you guys got into philosophy as a way of life. What got you to write this book in the first place?
I'll start like a few years back, sort of earlier maybe than where Megan's story takes off. I guess on the playground when I was about 7 years old. So I was on the playground, and I lived in Minnesota. I'm from Minnesota, and I distinctly remember, like, very young, I was on the playground, and of course it's Minnesota, and so I was playing with my friend who's a Lutheran, because like in Minnesota there's Lutherans and Catholics. And my Lutheran friend is like, hey, you're Catholic. And I was like, yeah, I'm Catholic. He's like, so you believe that, like, that communion is the body of Christ? And I was like, ah, I guess I do. And he's like, how does that work? And I was like, and I went home and I was like, Mom, like, what's going on here? At which point, you know, she started like introducing me to these words like transubstantiation and essence and accidental properties. And I suddenly saw like a logic behind the beliefs that, you know, were really important to me. I mean, you know, religion, Catholicism for us was our way of life, that was really attractive, right? That there was like a logical structure, that there was at least like a way of arguing and thinking about these things really impressed me. And at that point, I just became incredibly interested in apologetics, right? And I started thinking about arguing, right? Arguing that faith is rational or whatever it might be. And as I sort of progressed, right? Went through high school and then into college, this turned into an interest in and really a love of philosophy more generally. Because when you start with apologetics, right? You're starting from a particular point. You're sort of saying, look, I believe this. Now let me argue, you know, why that's rational and why you should believe it too. And at some point, if you're invested enough in the process, you realize, well, I'm just doing philosophy. And then you start saying, now what happens if I ask a question about the belief itself? Or what happens if I take seriously this argument that somebody else is offering to me, right? So I'd say, you know, that was kind of my entry point really into philosophy. And by the time I got to college, I went to the University of St. Thomas. And true to its name, St. Thomas plays a huge role there, so much so that in my philosophy classes, you know, as an undergraduate, you could just a legitimate move in any conversation, literally any conversation, was just proof texting the Summa. Like somebody would say something about, you know, very contemporary ethics. They'd be like, oh, you can't eat animals. And then you'd be like, well, look, St. Thomas says in, you know, question 4 of section 5 of, you know, whatever, whatever. And like, if they could show you the passage, everybody in the room was just like, ah, well, there it is. You know, that's what we believe now. And, you know, of course, you know, just seeing that there's this just beautiful, rich, historical, intellectual tradition, and just falling more of both with the method of philosophy and just realizing that, you know, the way in which this kind of activity directly connected up with my life, literally made a difference to like what I would do on Sunday morning or what I would do, you know, with respect to eating animals or not. Like this has always kind of been baked into my experience of philosophy. So I really kind of came to analytic philosophy and contemporary analytic philosophy from that perspective, right? I kind of came from a direction where really it was the way of life first, and then it was kind of layering philosophy on top of it. And then it was realizing, you know, in the past, you know, 10 years or so, that this is actually a way of doing philosophy that's got its own very rich historical tradition. You know, when I read Pierre Hadot's essay about the way in which ancient Greek and Roman philosophy can really best be understood, maybe only understood, as therapeutic in nature. Or when I was in grad school and I read Sextus Empiricus and I thought, oh, this guy just doesn't want to be anxious, right? It's not like he's crazy. It's not like he's like, I don't actually have hands, you know, in the way that like when I read some contemporary sort of skepticism and epistemology, right. I'm like, I'm not a brain enough. Like, what's going on here? I started realizing, no, some of the deep motivations for even the most contemporary philosophical issues, even the most live debates today, you know, some of those roots are in these very practical sort of things that we bump up against every day. I just want to stop worrying about my life being out of my control. And there, you know, we finally, you know, I guess here's the runway. I finally sort of thought like, okay, so these are my people. These are people, philosophers that I can connect with. And the traditions that are represented, as you well know, are phenomenal. And there, you know, there's Stoicism, there's Confucianism. I'm talking to Steve Engel this afternoon about Confucianism. There's obviously a lot of religious traditions that do philosophy in this mode. And I've just found it to be so rich and enriching and just personally so important to me and to my life that I find it actually more difficult to separate out philosophy from my daily life than I do to apply it to my daily life in some ways.
Nice. Yeah, actually, you mentioned Steve Engel, and we're going to have him on May 5th about his new book on Confucianism. Yeah. And it's interesting, Paul, to me that you mentioned transubstantiation, because when I realized that we're not talking metaphorically, I instead of running to my mother, who wasn't really well-versed on these things, I went to my priest, and he did not give me a good explanation. I have to say that was the beginning of my path in the other direction, but sure. It's interesting that it can work either way. Well, let me ask you something. So let's start talking about the actual content of the book. So early in the book, you make a distinction between what you call the surveyed life and the examined life. Can you explain what you mean by that distinction and why it is important for the project of the book and the course that this book relates to? Do you think that this issue raises problems for certain empirically oriented approaches to the good life, this distinction between surveyed life and examined life? Both of you, what do you think?
I'm happy to start off. Working around universities right now, as you guys probably know, one of the top issues is how to serve students who are undergoing crises of well-being because of the last 2 years of the disruption of the pandemic, or because of all the difficulties facing modern life. There are just these abysmal statistics about what our college students are going through. And a lot of colleges are trying to design courses and curricula that speak into those challenges. And one of the most common approaches is to teach those courses out of positive psychology programs and to say, we are going to measure the effect of various interventions on perceived subjective well-being or reports of subjective well-being, and then recommend interventions to students as a result. So it turns out that like data tells you the magic number for income to feel happy is $80,000 a year. So we're going to teach freshmen who are really anxious about jobs and internships that they should be targeting an $80,000 a year job. And it's fine if they don't get a $200,000 a year job, they'll still be happy. or trying to help.
Don't let them come to New York, however, because that's not
totally. We send a lot of Notre Dame students into those six-figure jobs, not as philosophy professors. Or, you know, the one of the key examples from a lot of these courses is like developing a gratitude practice. So like once a week, write a note of gratitude to somebody else, and that reports like higher levels of subjective well-being. And these courses are great as far, you know, it's great to write thank you notes. It's super great to have a grip on the appropriate role that money plays in making you feel happy. But a lot of these courses are also taught as the course that is going to speak into the happiness and well-being problems that young people face. And these courses are a drop in the bucket when it comes to like the really big existential problems that we're facing, certainly coming off of 2 years of a pandemic, and certainly when you're in this kind of pivotal moment in your development, when you're trying to plan what kind of good adult life you're going to pursue. So in the book, one of the things we try to do, and it's in the introduction, it's meant to be a little bit controversial, is to say, you know, these approaches to living the good life, gathering evidence about how different kinds of practices make people feel, they're important. They can play a role in helping you develop healthy eating and sleep habits and healthy gratitude practices, mm-hmm. but they are not even close to sufficient. And if you're aware of the tradition of virtue ethics in the East and West in philosophy, you'll know. If you're, you know, you're reading your Epicurean, maybe you got some Epicureans on this phone call that want to fight about it, which would be great. But if you, you know, if you've read these debates as they've gone on for 2400 years, you realize that there are much bigger questions, sometimes really morally serious questions about what we're aiming for in our life that will never be settled by these kinds of surveys. And in fact, the surveys are particularly unreliable when we're in periods of massive disruption, like the one that we're currently in. And that's where philosophy can actually be a huge aid, and it ought to be something that we're teaching and thinking about and arguing about more seriously. And the methods of philosophy, especially the methods of virtue ethics, very much deserve pride of place in these conversations about what kind of lives we want to live. So we meant to be kind of critical of the survey method. It's been an area where I don't know about Paul, but I've gotten some fan mail from people who are very fond of the kind of positive psychology approaches. But we mean for this to be provocative.
Right, Paul. Yeah. What's your take?
Yeah, good. So I'll start here. I love self-help books. Like I'm just kind of like a self-help book junkie. Like I used to work at an independent bookstore in Milwaukee, and whenever they had like a new self-help book, it was like improve your whatever, they just hand it to me and they'd be like, can you read this and, you know, tell people what it's about. And I love them. I mean, I think there's something really attractive just about the idea of improving yourself, becoming better, becoming more efficient, whatever it might be. But one thing that I often run up against as I'm listening to these, I usually listen to them on Audible on like triple speed, you know, like while I'm doing the dishes. But one thing I come up against, and I find this to be an experience that, you know, I often will connect with people on, because I find that a lot of people will run into this. Oftentimes, self-help books, they just don't quite go deep enough, is one way of saying it. And I don't think it's just because they're, you know, not like doing empirical psychology or, you know, gathering data in the right way. I think they're doing all these things really excellently. But sometimes there's just a limit to how far you can go depending on like the methodology that you're using, right? So I'll give an example. I read a great book, a really fantastic book on The Power of Habit by Charles Duhigg a while back. He wrote another book recently called Harder, Better, Faster, something like that. And it's you know, in line with a lot of these great books like Cal Newport's Deep Work and these things. And the book is like, look, you're a mess. Like, get yourself together, learn how to schedule your day, and you're not going to waste so much time and procrastinate. I read these books and it works. It's fantastic. Like, you know, I've developed better habits because of it, or I've become more productive. But, you know, 6 months in, I suddenly stop and I think like, why do I want to be productive? Right. And I suddenly think like, you know, in becoming more productive, I've actually made my life worse in some ways. Like I have, you know, taken out of my life all of the inefficient ways I used to communicate with people by now designing a fantastic email process where I only have to send one email and then the other person has to do all the work, right? And then I can just like walk it. And now I've taken out of my life the sort of walk into somebody's office and be like, hey, what's going on about this thing? And And a lot of times, not only are those things, you know, productive in themselves, I mean, that'd be kind of self-defeating. It was like, oh, it's more productive to be, you know, just engaging in these other old ways. But there's something deeply valuable and beautiful about living a life where there's some leisure baked in, right? Okay, so what's the problem? It seems to be something like this. A self-help book, kind of a traditional self-help book, it's got to assume, here's your goal, and I'm going to show you how to do it better. And that's great because a lot of the goals are obvious. Stop smoking, get in an exercise routine, sleep better. Like Megan was saying, yeah, okay, that's great. But what happens when you hit the deeper crisis and you ask yourself, do I want to work? Like not do I, like how do I, you know, make myself more productive at work? Do I want to work? Do I need to work? Why do I feel shame? Why do I feel deep shame when I am not sending emails at 4 p.m.? Why do I feel shame, right? Is that because I'm like rightly attuned to the fact that now I'm not being productive, I'm not being a good person? Or is it the iron cage, man? Is it the system? Does capitalism have its claws in me? I don't know, right? Now, these are philosophical questions, right? But they're deeply practical as well. And so one way that I describe the book to people is I say, okay, philosophy can be deep self-help, right? You're not going to read this book and lose 10 pounds. Like, I don't know, maybe you will, but it won't be costly related to your reading the book. But you are going to have a place to go when you want to ask and start answering and start dialoguing about the questions that keep you up at night, right? Do you want to work? Do you want to make as much money as possible? What do you actually need to invest in a loving relationship with somebody? Is death the worst possible thing? These are the things, again, these are the things that I think are often below the surface in these kind of crises that people have that often send them to the self-help section. And they're exactly where philosophers have been for thousands of years. And in a way, I just feel like we're saying, hey guys, like, you know, come on over to the philosophy section for a bit. We'll have a conversation. We'll have a dialogue about it. So I guess that's
I like that your way to put it in terms of deep self-help, because, you know, there's a lot of skepticism, especially in academic circles, about self-help. It was interesting that Megan said, I'm not really that much into positive psychology. And you started out by saying, oh yeah, I love self-help books. Give me more. I'm kind of in between those two positions, right? So I understand, as you were saying earlier, that, yeah, of course we want to help ourselves. And some of that help does have to deal with pretty straightforward issues. Like you were saying, you know, I want to get healthier, more exercise and all that sort of stuff. But some of the stuff that is really important is deeper, and that's where the psychology doesn't go. That needs the philosophical approach. Yeah, I like that. Rob, I think you have the next question.
Yeah, and I want to start off by saying that actually I believe I've lost a little weight causally related to my reading of your book, because I read it on my while I ride my bicycle, right?
I'm putting that on the paperback.
Oh, I was going to say, well, yeah, will you please write an Amazon review and give it 5 stars and be like, I read this book and lost 40 pounds. That would be incredibly
helpful. Yeah, so I think that counts as causally related, right? I wanted to ask specifics, you know, since I'm a Greek philosophy guy, right, about some of the stuff you said about Plato and the Sophists, right? And you tie it to Frankfurt's famous notion of bullshit. And you made the point, or you seem to suggest at least, that the idea that we accept something as true as opposed to just bullshit or something like that can come across as like arrogant, intolerant, and so on, because it seems to imply that other people are wrong, right? And it seems to me, and I think to Massimo as well, and to a lot of my other colleagues I've talked to, it seems like a student response to that is to say, well, I guess that's just your opinion, man, right? To quote another famous philosopher. And I'm kind of curious, like, is that your sense of it too? And do you see it more or less in this class? Have you seen so many trends or anything like that?
Yeah, I can go first if that's right, Megan. So I would say I have a diagnosis of philosophy intro student relativism, and it's controversial, and it's surely it doesn't generalize, but here's what it is in my case. When I first started teaching and just, you know, getting in the classroom and talking to students, I found that relativism was often a defensive and protective maneuver that students would make to get me to stop pushing on their most deeply held beliefs, right? So I'd be like, look, like, you know, oh, you're a vegan? Let me tell you, you know, and I'd kind of start questioning them, right? And when you do that, especially when you've got the, you know, a bit of training, when you've done a bit of philosophy and when you know sort of argument and logic, you can map this out, you've got a lot of power, and that puts somebody in a really vulnerable position and not one that's comfortable at all. And if you don't trust the person who is exerting that kind of power over you, the best thing to do is to say the thing that will get them to stop, right? I mean, you could walk out, but you can't do that in my class because otherwise I'll fail you, right? Like, I have that power too, right? And so a student will say like, you know what? I think everything's true and everybody's right. And that's my view. And they're like, but that's incoherent. They're like, that's also great. I'll take it on board. And in a way, I think like, that's fair, man. That's fair, you know, as not as a sort of logical, you know, rational move in the argument, but just I get why they're doing that. Okay, so one thing that I think our class uses as a way of combating that is we consider, you know, philosophy as a way of life, but we also, we encourage students to think about their work in our class, not as like, you know, getting all the right answers in philosophy or even knowing what philosopher thought what thing, but as writing a philosophical apology. And we literally have them at the end of the semester turn in a thing called a philosophical apology. You know, it's like 12, 15 pages long. And it's their answer to the four big questions that structure our course. And we ask them to write it like Augustine wrote the Confessions, right? Or like, you know, Socrates sort of, you know, recounts in the apology. What we're doing is we're saying, tell us, like, given the story of your life, like, given wherever you're at, like, where you're coming into this class from, tell us where you started and tell us where you're at now and tell us where you see that going. Now, when you take that approach, there's a lot of different pedagogical challenges. One of those is, okay, how do you get them to actually do philosophy? Because they'll start writing it and they'll be like, well, I think this and I think that and I think this other thing. And it's been a huge, you know, sort of pedagogical challenge that we've worked on for many years. And I think we're in a great spot now, because what will happen is a student will say, look, one of my most deeply held beliefs is that you've got to trust authority sometimes. You say, well, why? And they start telling a story and they say, you know, gosh, I wish I had like one like right off the top of my head. I don't, so I'm going to make it up. You know, they say, look, you know, when I first came to Notre Dame, I realized I've only ever believed what I believed because my parents told me so. And so I stopped going to church. And then they said, and suddenly my life was hollow and empty. And I realized that if I don't trust somebody in a tradition, I can't think my way out of that tradition, right? And so over the course of the semester, whatever, I just decided, like William James, to say, I'm going to act as if this is true for the time being. I'm going to see where it gets me. And I'm going to try to argue my way either into this tradition or out of this tradition. And we have students that go both ways, right? Some of our favorite apologies are students who say, I've never said this to anyone ever, but I'm an atheist. And here's why. We have some students who say, like, you know, I just discerned I'm going to the Catholic priesthood. And they're like, oh, okay. You know, like, I don't take full responsibility here for either of these. But I guess what, you know, what I'm saying here is, you know, the role that we then get to play in the class is we get to be an interlocutor. We get to, like, accompany them. We get to kind of walk with them. And when you establish a little trust, you can suddenly say, like you would say to your best friend who is undergoing a massive change in their life, well, wait, have you thought about this? Like, I'm on your side here. Maybe I don't believe what you believe, but hey, if I was you, I might think about this thing. And that is a way into a sort of worldview and a relationship that is much less threatening. I haven't seen a student espouse relativism for the past 3 years in the class. And I think it's in part because of the way that we're trying to approach it. So, okay, that's what I would say.
Megan, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think there's an interesting question. I get the relativism actually less from our undergraduates, much more from my faculty colleagues who are not in philosophy. So I'm in an interdisciplinary research center, and I spend most of my week now with folks in sociology and history and English departments. And, you know, if you asked me a couple of years ago, I would have been like, oh, well, they're all just knee-jerk relativists and they don't understand what the problems with relativism are. And now, after a few years of trying to do philosophy in these environments, one of the things I've realized is that when philosophers start to try to pursue the truth with somebody and they get, they get told, like, that's just your opinion, sometimes it's because the philosopher is not doing philosophy particularly well. Like, we are, some of my colleagues who we are tempted to label as relativists, instead point out, I think quite rightly, that we're bad listeners, that we oftentimes are not willing to try to understand the question that's on the table before we start trying to reason through it. And so it does seem like we're just trying to control the conversation or exert power over them. You can think of an example, thinking of one that's maybe a live issue on a lot of campuses also right now, is like anti-racism and trying to understand how we talk about racism. And the philosopher comes in and says, like, you know, look, we're going to pursue the truth together about what the basis of human dignity is. And I'm going to use my tools of philosophical distinctions and analysis to help you get to a realization about how this debate is working. And we think we're coming in with a gift that we're going to offer to our colleagues who've worked on racism in history and sociology for decades. And in fact, we have not bothered to listen for a minute. And this gets to Paul's point about what their actual experience is or why they care about this issue so deeply. And we come in saying, like, you know, here, Descartes's going to solve this problem for you. Descartes has the solution to racism in the United States. And we're just going to make all the distinctions and then look and see if the system works. And then a lot of times they're like, man, I really just wanted you to take a beat to think about what the, if you understood the problem before you tried to philosophize me out of it. And so when they give us the charge of relativism, I think sometimes what people mean to say back to the philosopher is, you're talking about something else than what I care about. And so that's kind of your, you go do your thing, have your, like, write your book about Descartes and bias. But if you want to talk about my thing, come and, like, you know, listen and try to seek to understand a little bit before we try to reason about the truth on it. And there is a certain kind of arrogance that philosophers bring to a lot of these conversations. And this is what got Socrates in trouble. I mean, we should have learned our lesson, again, 2,400 years ago, because Socrates would come in like guns out, ready to prove anything to anybody. Or not, he kept having to apologize for, he's not trying to prove anything. He doesn't know where the conversation is going to end. But sometimes people were like, your treatment of me was not welcome in this particular context. And I think sometimes when philosophers face this charge of relativism right now, it's because we really have not bothered to sit down and understand why somebody cared about the truth in the question to begin with.
Yeah. Rob, did you have a, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I wanted to, just sort of raise something. Yeah. You know, I know Paul, I think we've chatted about it anyway, but I often teach, I don't know about often, but I teach some of this philosophy as a way of life stuff in prisons sometimes. And I just finished up a course, and this specific issue sort of came up specifically with a couple of students who used something very similar to what you were saying, Paul, about the idea that it's a way to sort of avoid conflict, right? Especially when there are power differentials and stuff. And one of the things I found in that context useful is it's about trust building, right? And you know, disagreeing in that context, which is generally a little more high stakes than most of our freshman classes, the need to avoid conflict is pretty high. But what they have to learn is my disagreeing with them is not dissing, right? My disagreeing with them, my engaging with their argument is a sign of respect from a philosopher. And I find when we can sort of develop trust over that, let's talk about the argument and not each other. That goes pretty well. And I don't know if that rings at all familiar But
oh, totally.
Are you, I mean, are you making an analogy between your prisoners and our students? Is that what you mean? Is that what you get it?
I do that all the time.
All right.
The classic philosophical to make sure. Move. We're all prisoners looking at the wall.
Exactly. Sorry, yeah, Paul, go ahead.
No, it certainly rings true. And I'll even just say like another little anecdote kind of supports this is, my biggest relationship mistake in my entire life was thinking that other people, including my wife, when we were dating and before, like when we were getting engaged, would take argument and disagreement as a sign of respect automatically, right? Which is not even what I did, right? When I was in high school, when I was in college learning about philosophy, I would feel attacked. But you get into it and then you sort of are initiated in a community. You immediately forget what it felt like. And then, you know, I'd go to her and I'd say, well, here are the 7 reasons why I think you're wrong about this decision that we're about to make. And it was just like, you know, could I have been any more sort of tone deaf, right? So I think that's completely right. I mean, it totally rings true to me.
Makes sense. I'm going to ask the next question, but before I do, I want to remind our listeners here in the live version of the podcast that you can post your questions in the chat and Rob and I will take a look. And if there's enough time in the next 20 minutes or so, we'll post the question to Paul and Megan. So this is a good time to start posting questions if you have any. So in a sense, my question is kind of a follow-up on what the discussion has been so far, because it goes back to your the part in your book where you talk about Plato and the sophists. And we all like to dislike the sophists, of course, but as we know, so there were villains, certainly in the way Plato puts them up for us for our inspection. However, later on, Cicero, for instance, who, as you know, interestingly, was a lawyer as well as a statesman and a philosopher, actually argued that to be skilled in oratory is an integral component of doing philosophy, because the goal is not just to put forth a good argument; it's in fact to persuade people. Right? So that's right. You don't want to do bullshit. You don't want to bullshit people because that's not a good argument. That you don't have the logos, as Aristotle would put it, on your side. But at the same time, oratory should, to in fact, you know, good dialectical skills should actually be part of the package, which may make you come across as a sophist, but it's not, because if those skills are in the interest of a good philosophical point or argument, then they actually should be. It's something that we should do. We should be encouraged to do, as opposed to the way in which Plato or Socrates sometimes put it. It's like, no, any way you go in that direction, you're just doing something that is not acceptable. The question to you is, what do you think in general of the role of dialectics and, you know, oratory skills in philosophy? Because I've seen my colleagues both in analytic departments in philosophy, and then before in my previous career as an academic in biology, so in the sciences, that any mention of anything other than rigorous argument for my analytical colleagues or empirical evidence for my biology colleagues is anathema. As soon as you go into, you know, persuasion and things like that, it's like, no, now you're trying to manipulate people, and that's a no-no. What's your take on that?
I can start. I think that we need to counter program that view. Massimo, like, this is totally what I learned in graduate school. It's all about this certain kind of rigorous way of writing and presenting ideas. And if the reader or the audience member at the talk doesn't understand it, so much the worse for them. Philosophy is meant to be like esoteric and difficult and have this high entry cost. And some ideas are hard. Quantum mechanics, extremely difficult. Like second order logic, you're right. You do need to take some courses. But there are lots of ideas in ethics, ideas about rationality and knowledge that are, you know, a lot of us believe are part of human nature to understand and grasp these questions. And why they pay philosophers the big bucks is to make these truths lovable. to help other people. Did you
say big bucks?
The big bucks. But to learn how to help people love the truth. And that, you know, as Plato reminds us, that kind of eros dimension of pursuit of the truth involves rhetoric and dialectic. It involves being clear. It involves finding really compelling and gripping cases and thought experiments. It involves trying to meet the public where they're at in the cave and walk out with them. And we have not prioritized that in academic philosophy nearly enough, in certainly in the course of my career, but I think in the last, in the post-war era, the last 80 years of academic philosophy in the English-speaking world, I don't think we've done a particularly good job of training philosophers who have rigor, but also have the will and the capacity to present these ideas in a compelling way to people who are not already philosophers. And, you know, it's just not that, you know, also to go back to Plato, it's not that good to get out of the cave by yourself. You've got to go back in and bring others out with you. And we seem to be, to just kind of lost touch of that part of our charge, I think, in the way that we train philosophers now and the kinds of philosophical work that we reward. And it's something that's not healthy for the discipline, and also kind of an abnegation of one of our responsibilities.
Yeah. So, Paul, what about this connection or disconnect between oratory and argument?
Yeah, so one of the things I find really puzzling is that a lot of the analytic philosophers, and these are the people I hang around with most. So a lot of the analytic philosophers that will articulate some of the views that you were talking about a second ago, we've got to totally divorce these things from one another, et cetera. They'll also say things like, well, I don't actually believe the argument I'm about to present, right? They're like, right. I don't believe any of this stuff, right? Like, I'm just exploring logical space. And that's totally fine, right? You could, you know, just want to say, what's the best argument for this position or that position? But if you ask them like, okay, so then why are you defending it? What comes out is, you know, some bizarre stuff. Well, it's like, well, yeah, I don't know. This is publishable. Okay, maybe that's like the most sort of odious version of this. Or it's like, well, because, you know.
It's really utilitarian, like, yes.
Yeah. I mean, this is how the dialectics go on or something like that. Okay, but I sometimes want to take people by the shoulders and just be like, but don't you love the truth? Like, don't, like, aren't you ultimately aiming at the truth? Isn't that what this enterprise is about? And to illustrate here, to illustrate the point, I'm going to tell you guys a story that didn't make it into the book. So this is, look at this. This is bonus material. It was going to be in the Love the Truth chapter, but it didn't make it in for quite good reasons and obvious reasons probably in a second. But okay, so a while back, I met this guy and I met him, I don't even know, you know, I really like conspiracy theories online and kind of researching them and figuring out why are people attracted to these and sort of what is the epistemic status of the various claims. There's this guy who has spent the last 8 years of his life really thoroughly sort of step-by-step debunking conspiracy theories and conspiracy theories about the Sandy Hook Elementary School in particular. Okay, so he told me a story about how there's a philosophy professor, James Fetzer, who's retired now but works at the University of Minnesota Duluth, who is very famous online for promulgating these conspiracy theories, right? And this individual, the guy who I talked to who debunks the theories, he goes by the name Shill Murray. It's not his real name, but he actually knows people who have had, you know, their real name. They've gotten doxxed. They've gotten like physical threats of violence from conspiracy theorists. So he goes by the pseudonym. So Shill said, came across James Fetzer's stuff, saw Fetzer was doing an AMA on Reddit, right? And Ask Me Anything on Reddit. And he thought, well, I'll just, this guy's a philosopher. I'll go there and I'll present my argument because it you know, just systematically disproves this claim that he's made and he'll see the light. And so we went to Reddit and he did. And Fetzer's like, nah, he's like, well, what about this thing? You know, he like asked another question. And Shill's like, how could he think that, right? So he spent 8 years of his life putting arguments on a blog, systematically taking every conspiracy theory and debunking it step by step. Okay. So at the end of our conversation, I asked Shill, I said, look, Shill, you got to help me. You're an amateur cyber sleuth. You spend extensive amount of time, like extensive amounts of your personal time researching conspiracies online, and you claim to really care about what happened to you. James Fetzer, he's an amateur cyber sleuth. He spends extensive amounts of his time researching conspiracy theories, and he claims to really care what happened at Sandy Hook. What's the difference between you two? Mm-hmm. And he said, he has not read Frankfurt. He, you know, hasn't, you know, come across this sort of technical notion of bullshit. He said, oh, well, Fetzer's a bullshitter. And I was like, what does that mean to you? And he said, when he asks questions, he doesn't care about the answers.
Right.
So the sort of you know, deficiency here is an emotional deficiency or an emotional, sort of an attitudinal deficiency. He doesn't love the trick. He is merely wielding these arguments as a way of having power online. And I don't know, like, I don't know why he's so into like influencing so many people on the internet, but people are into a lot of weird things. But that's what Scheel said. He said, that's the difference, right? The difference is I love the truth and he doesn't love the truth, right? And so when I encounter people who are making these kinds of arguments, I think if you love the truth, if you love it so much that you want to devote your whole life to professional philosophy, right? Then you've got to bring people into that, right? And all of these people, if they're teaching an intro class, you're going to have to present an argument that you know is false. I present, you know, Anselm's ontological argument. And the version I present is surely false, right? It does not work. But when I present it, I motivate it as much as I can. I sort of build it up and I sort of let it hang in the air. And some of my students think like, yeah, wait, that works. I'm persuaded by that, right? And then I say, okay, but well, what about this thing, right? And you've got to sort of go step by step and say, look, if you love the truth more than you love any particular belief that you've got, you're going to end up in the right place. I mean, that's, you know, in a way, just how I would kind of define philosophy as a way of life. It's like, trust the process, man. So to me, you know, and this is just reinforcing what Megan's saying, that love of truth is going to have to take into account. It's going to have to recognize that you know, philosophy is not a just abstract, detached, purely, I don't know if they would agree with this, scientific enterprise, where we're just like, okay, we're just objectively describing the logical connections and the space of reason. And like, I don't have to like actually invest in this at all. It's not like that. At least it's not like that for me. And I don't think it's like that for most people, if they're honest with themselves.
Yeah, the description you just gave reminded me very much of the experiences that I had when I was at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville as an evolutionary biologist, and occasionally I debated creationists. And I initially, naively, I went up on the stage thinking, well, I'm a scientist, I know what I'm talking about, this guy doesn't, so, you know, surely this is going to be a piece of cake. And of course, it wasn't going to be a piece of cake at all. And part of the reason, a great part of the reason, is precisely because it seemed like my opponent usually didn't really care about the truth. He knew what the truth was, and therefore everything else that I was, you know, saying, it was like whenever he was asking a question, the goal was to embarrass me or to put me on the defensive. It was never to actually listen to what I had to say. And then this was before the publication of Bullshit on Bullshit. So when Frankfurt came up with that book, I said, oh yeah, I recognize the pattern. Yes, I know. I've been there. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
This is the experience I had when Aaron James came out with that book, Assholes. I was like, ah, okay. Yeah. All right.
Exactly.
I don't know. There's a pattern here. I don't know.
Pattern.
Yeah.
Rob, I think you have the next question.
Yeah, let me ask this one. So, like, you guys teach at Notre Dame. The course you teach is God and the Good Life. Part two of your book is God and the Good Life and all of that. But there's, of course, a lot of evidence that we're becoming a more secular society, at least here in the West, right? More people are identifying as non-religious or as agnostics or atheists. So I'm wondering what you think God and the Good Life, whether the book or even with some of your students, might have to say to the non-religious.
You know, I was at a bar the other night, and I was at a bar with
That's a great way to start the answer. Yes. Okay. You got my attention. Yep.
With a former student who's now a colleague. We worked together on a lot of this philosophy as a way of life stuff. And he was, I believe, raised Christian, sort of vaguely Christian, is now an avowed atheist, very atheist. And I asked him, I said, do you pray? I was like, we just have these meetings where we can just ask anything. I was like, do you sort of have any spirituality? Like, do you pray? And his answer, you know, shocked me. I mean, he was like, of course I do. And I was like, well, what do you mean, of course you do? And he's like, look, every experience that you've got and that you capture in very particular religious language of the sacred or of prayer or this ritual or whatever it might be, those just don't disappear, at least for him. You know, he was sort of raised religious and now he's an atheist. He said, those don't disappear. They sort of change into something else, right? And part of his sort of philosophical journey has been trying to integrate, you know, his sort of religious instincts, the ones that were either trained into him or that he had from birth or whatever it might be, to take those and reconcile them with what he now takes to be one of life's most important truths, that there is no God, right? So I think people that would say, oh, I you know, I'm not religious, or you know, I'm maybe spiritual but not religious, or I'm totally secular. When I sit down at a bar with them and I have half a drink, we're suddenly in the same space and we're talking about the way that we experience the kinds of things that in religion, we've got very clear language that goes all the way back to, you know, the very beginning. We sort of capture it in a certain way. I find those experiences are shared, right? So one of the things that I hope the second half of the book does for somebody who's approaching it from that perspective, right? From the perspective of maybe they've never been religious, maybe they, you know, were raised non-religious, but they're at least open to thinking about it, right? If they're not, then like they should read the first half of the book and then buy two more copies and then give it to their friends. And then, yeah, I don't know. But if they're open to thinking about it, if they're open to the dialogue, right? What I'm hoping they'll take away from this is like, look, here's somebody, and I, you know, I genuinely hope that this is true of me. I could be self-deceived, I don't know. Here's somebody that cares more about the truth than about being right, but that is so thoroughly sort of embedded in a particular religious tradition and a deeply philosophical religious tradition, a religious tradition where nothing's off limits. You can ask philosophical questions about the Eucharist, about the body of the Lord and, you know, God of the universe, and you can debate it, and you could be right or you could be wrong about it. Nothing's off limits. Here's what it looks like from here. And the sort of dialogue I want is, okay, what does it look like from there, right? And that's just a conversation, I think, that we can all sort of enter into, right? Now, there are conversations that happen on this college campus that you're going to have to approach differently, right? If you're in a theology department, you might say, well, here's what we presuppose, and here's sort of the answer to these questions. Now, let's start there. And I think even there, you know, there's a way in which you could have different kinds of dialogues or whatever. But philosophy is not like that. Philosophy says, like, hey, this is why I think, this is why I'm totally convinced that this, you know, religious belief is not just true, but can shape in meaningful ways my life. What do you think about it? Like, do you have an argument against it? Because I'm going to take that on board if you do, right? So that's what I would hope, is that this is sort of the opening sort of move in an ongoing dialogue about some of these issues that I think are kind of universally experienced, or at least very like widely experienced.
I would say too, on my end, I think I noticed this in a lot of the conversations I have with our undergraduates here and when I'm visiting other universities, we're kind of in a cultural milieu right now in the US and in Europe, where everybody thinks they know what various religions are, but a lot of times their assumptions are like really narrow and flat. So people find out that you're a Catholic and they just assume you're like it's a political party. Like there's a kind of statement of domestic political beliefs that characterize your religious faith, and they don't know much more about it than that. Or people hear that you're an atheist and they just assume like you agree to these kinds of things right now, and that's what your atheism amounts to. One of the things that philosophy is really good at, and I think particularly is needed right now in our conversations, at least in the US, is helping us get a little bit deeper about just what even a phenomenon is. Like, what is Catholicism? That's a question a ton of my Notre Dame undergraduates have. What parts of it am I allowed to wonder about? What parts of it am I allowed to doubt? What kind of life am I, a 2022 human, going to pursue if I claim it's a Catholic life? Same to Paul's point about an atheist life. Like, there's a lot of dimensions to it, and it's the kind of thing, at least in the Christian tradition, you're allowed to think about, and you're allowed to contribute to developing this tradition. And philosophy is really good, you know, the relationship between faith and reason is really good at helping people in a tradition figure out what it is, and people who want to engage or criticize a tradition figure out exactly what it is that they want to engage or criticize. And right now these debates have gotten a little bit like narrow and flat, and we make a lot of assumptions about other people without trying to think deeply about just what even these religious questions are.
Yeah, thank you. We are almost at the end. I have one more question that it's actually directed at Paul, but Megan might have some opinions about the general topic anyway. I read an article, Paul, recently where, if I am not mistaken, the article pointed out that you are one of the philosophers that is active on TikTok of all places, right? So I wanted to ask, so TikTok, I'm pretty active on social media, but TikTok is one of those places where I haven't gone, at least not yet. So on the one hand, you know, what is it like, and what do you think that contributes to philosophy? And by the way, the same article says you also worked in as an improv comic.
Yeah.
Because so one of the ways in which I explain to my students what I'm doing up there and why I need their attention and I need them not to look at their cell phones is because I am performing just like a comedian, although I'm not as funny usually. And so that's, they need to think of me in the same, and it kind of seems to work. So let's talk about TikTok, social media, etc., from the point of view of your particular experience. And then Megan, if you have something to add on the same sort of what is philosophy doing on social media, particularly certain kinds of media. There's also not exactly related, but it is about you, Paul, so I'm going to ask you anyway. One of our listeners was asking, since you mentioned veganism earlier, whether you are vegan and why, but I suppose we may not have time to get into that, but if you want to address that very, very quickly,
sure.
That's fine. But TikTok, so...
Yeah, good. So the vegan thing is really easy. No, I'm not a vegan. I smoke meat okay. almost every day. I love meat so much. And I'm not unreflectively not a vegan. I've got an office mate and we talk about this stuff all the time. And I do think it's a very serious issue and it's worth thinking about. But I'll just say, I'm going to go home and have a steak after this. All right. So TikTok. look, TikTok, so you asked what it's like. And I'll tell you, it is a hot mess in a beautiful way, in the way that Twitter is a hot mess. In the way that, you know, it is designed for very particular reasons, right? The way TikTok works is, you know, you upload very short videos between, you know, say 7 seconds, and now it's like a minute and 90 seconds, or it can be longer, but really the most popular videos are maybe 30 or 40 or 50 seconds at the most. And if you don't like it, if you're on your phone, you don't like, you just swipe up and there's another video, you swipe up, there's another video, you swipe up and there's another video. And so in some ways, you know, it's taking all of the kind of trends of social media, the sort of shortening of the attention span, the sort of elevating of the kind of shocking content, et cetera. And it's using right. that in a way that really draws on features of our brains, et cetera, that you know, we might not want to be exploring this particular direction. So on the one hand, when people say, oh, you're on TikTok, should I get on TikTok? I'm like, I don't know. On the other hand, I'm very optimistic about the way that we can use social media or any media. I think technology historically has, you know, always had this feature where you can use it to good ends. And I'm interested in always asking that question, can we use this to learn? Can we use this to build a philosophical community to seek the truth, you know? And I'm willing to do just about any social media platform, anything that comes out, I'm willing to try it out and see if we can. Here's what I've learned about TikTok. I think you definitely can, right? One of the big challenges just as a philosophy teacher is making sure that you are setting yourself a reasonable learning goal within whatever constraints you've got. You walk into a classroom and you've got 50 minutes to teach Aristotle. Like, that's insane, you guys. There's no way that you can do that, right? If you're going to teach all of Aristotle in 50 minutes, like, try like 50 years, right? Okay, but we do it, right? Because we realize, hey, this is a constraint and there's some good to be had here. This is a goal worth having, to have my students walk out of here with more of an idea about this particular part of Aristotle than they had when they walked in. Okay, now just scale that down. Say you got 25 minutes. You think like, okay, now I can't really cover eudaimonia and compare that to other forms of happiness. Okay, but what could I do? Well, I could introduce them to the distinction between instrumental goods and ultimate goods. I can do that in 25 minutes. You can now scale that down, right? And you think, can you do anything in 30 seconds? And I hope if you go to, you know, my Twitter account, I hope you'll agree. Yeah, I think definitely we can do this. We can do this in 30 seconds, in 90 seconds. You can't ask all the questions. And certainly you could ask some questions in the wrong way. You could be like, oh, let's hear the meaning of life in 90 seconds. That's just going to be a joke, TikTok, because you can't do that in 90 seconds. Okay, but we can do something. Turns out people in the world love logic puzzles. They love the idea that there's got to be a simple answer here, but whatever answer I think of, there's a very clear reason why that's not going to work, right? And so some of these paradoxes, I've done some paradoxes on TikTok. They're the first step. They're an entry point. And somebody will look at this, and there's a lot of people on TikTok, just very different backgrounds, sitting there in the comments, just going back and forth. And they're thinking, well, this is obviously the answer. And somebody's like, well, have you heard of this thing? Because that doesn't really work for this reason. And suddenly dialogue's happening. And there's that kind of awakening. There's that kind of spark that, again, in my sort of optimistic technology sort of land, is gonna sort of move somebody a little bit in the direction. It's gonna start turning the head toward, the fire, which is gonna lead them to walk a little bit higher in the cave or whatever it might be. And I certainly do think, it's not unrelated what you said about the improv background. I worked at a professional improv theater in the Twin Cities in right. Minnesota for a couple of years when I was in college. And I find that was the best preparation for teaching that I could possibly have had, not just because, you can then kind of be funny and keep attention. In fact, that actually got in the way for me for a long time. I just sort of saw every class as a 50-minute stand-up set, and that was terrible. Like, my students were failing. It was not good at all. But because you start to realize that there are ways of architecting and shaping thought that can contribute to the way that we as humans are able to take information on board and start paying attention to something and seeing something. And if you just stand over here when you're talking about Socrates's view, and then you stand over here when you're talking about Glaucon, you can kind of embody it. You can kind of enact it in a way that just sort of takes away some of that irrelevant cognitive processing that a student would have to engage, in, if you were just like up there kind of reading in a monotone, like, and then this happened and that, you're sort of creating obstacles. In a way, this relates right. to the rhetoric bit. You're trying to take those obstacles away. So that's what I'll say about that.
Sounds great. Megan, any thoughts on social media, not necessarily TikTok, and philosophy?
I think I'm not on TikTok, but I am a huge like news consumer. So I read three major news sites all day, every day. And one thing that I've noticed, and I've been thinking about this for years, philosophy doesn't have to be put into pop culture. It's already there, latent. Like, we have philosophy, it's like Shakespeare, Plato, Aristotle, the Stoics, they're floating around in our imagination the same way Shakespeare is. One of the things that philosophers can contribute is pointing it out in the medium. Like, hey, guess what? Like, did you know this is Stoicism? Like, there's a whole book. If you like this Family Guy joke, you'll love the book that Marcus Aurelius wrote. If you everybody's kind of vaguely aware of Plato's cave, but some people need that extra nudge to go actually read book for the Republic. And so philosophers being on social media, being on YouTube, being where people are consuming popular culture helps nudge them towards the deeper wells. That's great. And the philosophy is always going to be floating around these debates anyway, because philosophy is just part of our cultural life. It's part of our thought process. But it's a great thing when we find opportunities to meet people where they're at and then kind of point them towards the more serious version of something that they're already enjoying. So I think TikTok can be great for that. I think YouTube and podcasting have already proven they're incredibly good at awesome. Serving that role. And this is going to be fantastic for philosophy in our century, I think.
I agree. Well, we are at the end of the hour. Thank you very much, Rob. Do you have any parting words or last question or something like that? Otherwise, we're going to wrap it up.
No, I think it's great to see both of you. And thanks so much for joining us today. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thanks, Paul and Megan. And let me conclude just by reminding people that the next episode of Philosophy as a Way of Life will feature John Sellers on Epicureanism as a Philosophy of Life. Join us for that one on Thursday, April 21st at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. If you want to register for that event, go to meetup.com and look for the New York Agora. And if you wish to hear past episodes of Philosophy as a Way of Life, go to anchor.fm/philosophy as a way of life or check us out on Spotify. See you next time and stay safe.